It is a minute past 8 o'clock, and you've got it on KHUM, Cutting, Eureka, Arcata, and Eureka Women's Club, and streaming on the web at KHUM.com. Our 18th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign is coming to a close today with our 18th Healing Breakfast. This is a tradition we've been doing for some time, and this is our second time we're at the Eureka Women's Club because it's just such a great venue. And so first I want to introduce our panel. We've got all kinds of stuff going on today. We've got music. We've got pastries from Velatini Baking Company. We've got wonderful coffee from Signature Coffee. We've got beautiful flowers all around the room from Sun Valley Floral Farm. But like I said, a wonderful panel of guests. And first off, I'd like to introduce my partner in crime for the past 18 years, Sherry Johnson. So, oh, there she's running back to her microphone.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Sherry.
Gina, could you come up front, please? Okay, that's where I was headed. Great. Live radio. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to our 18th Healing Breakfast. Stop the Violence, Start the Healing. End of our radio education campaign. And we have lots and lots of people to thank, which we will do later and throughout the program. So, before we get started, it is very important to acknowledge that we are on Wiat tribal land. Nothing in history, nothing that anyone says or does will ever change that. And we are grateful to be guests here today. So, with that, I think we also have another welcoming and beginning of our healing breakfast. And sister, would you please go up to the mic and give us our invocation? And just to describe sister, she looks absolutely beautiful.
Well, thank you. Thank you much. A good morning to all of you in Humboldt County and all of you here present. My name is Sister Juana Little with the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. I guess I'd like to say right off that how ironic, Stop the Violence on this November 22nd. Many of us in this room remember 1963. I was a young boy in school, and it was a most terrible day. And we lost a great man, a great President Kennedy, and later his brother, and Bobby Kennedy, and then Martin Luther King, and it just never seemed to get better after that. But some of us need healing, and I ask those of you who can hear me to please join me. I invite you to join me in a prayer here. Higher power, divine Lord, great spirit, we thank you for this beautiful morning. We bless you and we ask you to, and we bless you and we ask you to bless all of us here who are about to receive this food and drink. May those of us who have experienced brutality or bullying be fortified and find security and safety. For those of us who have suffered domestic abuse, find peace and tranquility. For those of us who have the scars of rape, may we be healed. And may your higher power send healing blessing from the north and the south and the east and the west to you and your family and your friends and fill your hearts with joy. Amen and all women. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I also want to acknowledge this date of November 22nd. It is not a coincidence that November 22nd was chose back in 1990 to be National Stop the Violence Day. Back when I helped create this, it was just a one-day thing to start with, National Stop Violence Day. And we chose November 22nd, a day of horrific violence that changed the world forever, and turn it into a day of peace. And, of course, we must acknowledge that today, as incredible as it may seem, is also the 50th anniversary of the taking of the life of President John F. Kennedy. I, too, was just 6 years old at the time, but it changed my life forever. I'll never forget that. So, anyway, we've got a wonderful panel of guests that we've got here around us. So, Sherry, why don't you introduce who we've got with us today?
Well, I will certainly start with myself and let our guests introduce themselves. And I'm Sherry Johnson. I'm co-host for this many 18 years and director of field education at the Department of Social Work at Humboldt State University and the chair of the Humboldt County Domestic Violence Coordinating Council. And to my left.
Hi, I'm Janice Rollins-Dean, and currently I'm the interim behavioral health manager at United Indian Health Services in our behavioral health department. I'm very pleased to be here this morning.
Good morning. I'm Virginia Subia Belton. I'm currently a doctoral candidate with Pacifica Graduate Institute and a community member here in Humboldt County. I am researching the Indigenous knowledge system in intersection with the biomedical model and the end-of-life relationship. Certainly some issues of violence and healing to be explored there. Thank you.
I'm Carolyn Lehman, and I'm a survivor of both severe trauma in childhood and also cancer as an adult. And they actually, I spoke a couple of years ago at this breakfast on that intersection and how they relate to each other. I'm also the author of Strong at the Heart, which is a book of interviews with teen and adult survivors of sexual abuse who talk about how that abuse affected their lives and then also how they healed. And I'm bringing it out in paperback in a month. So this is, I brought the proof. I mean, it's technically called a proof when you look at it.
You actually wrote it.
We don't think you need to prove it.
I don't need to prove it, but I did bring a few hardcover copies if there's anyone who's interested in this.
And just let me add that is a really fantastic book, and it is truly healing. So
Thank
if
you.
Anybody thinks that they may want to just add that to their collection, but also to read something that will really change how you feel about what happened to you or someone that you love, I highly, highly recommend reading that book.
And I've got to add as well, really a wonderful, wonderful book. It's actually a collection of stories from survivors of all kinds of horrific circumstances, and you would think on the surface this could be a very depressing book. It's a very uplifting book because of the way these people have, they had terrible adversity, but what they've done since, it's truly inspiring.
Thank you. That was the intention. Well, thank you for them.
Indeed. I've, over the years, had a chance to actually talk to some of the folks who are featured in the book, which is quite a gift as well. So, again, this is live and open to the public. Everyone listening on the radio or online is certainly welcome to stop on by on this beautiful day. We know it's early in the morning, but you can stop on by, have a cup of coffee, some delicious pastries from Velatini, and maybe hear some wonderful music, and check out some of these resource tables that are all around the room. There are an amazing amount of resource tables all around this room. Just about every organization that does positive things in this community, they're represented here. And a chance for you to get some information, ask some questions, maybe get some help, whatever you want.
Or make a quilt square.
Or make a quilt square. That is right. Oceana Madrone, who I just spoke to the other day, is here with her lots of quilts that are up there looking absolutely beautiful. And you can certainly make a quilt square. Which is a wonderful thing. I was lucky enough to actually get one of these quilts a few years ago. It's one of our treasured things in our collection. So anyway, stop on by. It's at the Women's Club on J Street. Sherry, do you know the exact address?
You know, I was just looking for that. I'm just going to make it up and say 1915 J.
It's 15 something, actually.
Right.
I'm pretty sure. 1531. There we go. Mike has whispered in my ear. 1531.
That's what you get for making stuff up.
There we go.
So 1531.
1531 J.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not too far from the high school.
Right.
Actually, Eureka's small. That's not too far from anything, to be quite honest. So that's a great reason to stop on by here and be part of it. So I think what I want to do, I think starting off with some music is a great way to get this thing going. We've got an all-star vocal quartet put together just for this. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to hear some of this fantastic live music from our Healing Breakfast live at Eureka Women's Club on KHUM. All righty, and you've got it on KHUM. We are coming to you live from Eureka Women's Club, and it is our 18th Healing Breakfast. And please come on by, and we'd love to see you here. And we have got an all-star vocal quartet put together just for this event. They're called the Heartbeat Quartet. And this is Elizabeth Harrington and Joe Kaselka and Steve Nobles and Luke Sikora. And whatever you guys want to do, I'm fine with it. You guys are good. Take it away. Heartbeat Quartet. Now, for those of you listening at home, we disappeared for a little while. There was actually a little power outage here at the Women's Club. Don't know why, but we seem to be back. Everything seems to be working. The vocals never quit. They just kept on going. There was no lights, but you know what? They didn't need the power. They were powered on their own. Can you give us one more?
Oh, yeah.
We'd love to.
Excellent.
Is it the sky today, the way that the wind's pushing the clouds, or is it the late day sun stretching the shadows over the ground that brings on these memories of people and places that I've never seen, and voices so this person be? Is it that little town where I was born? Or maybe it's history, the faces of family that I've never known, somewhere across the sea.
Home, my home,
where is my
there's your face, my dear, and I know I'll never be walking alone. The love in your eyes makes it clear, telling me softly, this is my home,
my home.
Heartbeat Quartet right there, live here at our Healing Breakfast. Thanks, guys. We'll have them up a few more times yet. We've got several repertoire. And first of all, I've also acknowledged, you know, singing this early in the morning, this is not generally done. Vocalists are like, wait a minute, this is, okay, 2 a.m., fine, but this is a little bit on the early side. So anyway, we dealt with some pretty heavy topics over the course of this campaign this year, but this week we're dealing with healing, bringing it all together, bringing it all home with healing from trauma, and that's really what this whole thing is about. This Healing Breakfast is just to kind of, you know, acknowledge that a lot of us deal with a lot of pain in our lives. But the good news is there are a lot of wonderful people and resources who are there to help, share, commiserate, give wonderful advice, and help you through it. Because life goes on. We continue. We are survivors of whatever we might have to deal with. And as I said, we dealt with some pretty thorny topics throughout the course of this campaign this year.
Yes, and maybe it would be good to start us off with our keynote speaker. So if we could have Dr. Ronnie Swartz come up, Professor Swartz, and he will give us his words of, not to put pressure on him, wisdom.
Well, I'll tell you what. I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this opportunity to take a quick break and let Mr. Swartz gather his information, and we will take care of that right after these quick words from our sponsors. Again, you've got it on KHUM, and we're coming to you live from the Eureka Women's Club on J Street here in Eureka, and hopefully you can stop on by. Okay, and you've got it on KHUM. Again, coming to you live from Eureka Women's Club in Eureka. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. And we're about to hear our keynote address. But before we do, a good reminder from Sherry.
And Paula Arrowsmith-Jones is a regular guest for the past however many years of our campaign. And she is home recovering from a car accident, and we want to all just take a minute to send her positive healing energy and our love.
Absolutely. And that was a pretty scary thing. She was on her way to the radio station for her interview and got involved in this multi-car accident on Broadway. Anyway, without further ado, we've got our keynote speaker. We've got Dr. Ronnie Swartz joining us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the Wiat people for taking good care of the land we are on. Also, I want to thank KHUM for being committed to this event for so many years. And Sherry Johnson, she's been a good friend, colleague, ally, and role model to me for over a decade. And also thanks to the Eureka Women's Club for hosting this event. I'm going to have to read from what I've written a lot because I don't know how to memorize something this long. I don't know how the TED people do it. And I don't have a teleprompter to make it appear like I'm looking out at everyone when I'm really just reading something. I'm sitting at the dinner table with my 9-year-old daughter, my only child, and she looks worried. I haven't been well for what feels like a long time now, having a lot of difficulty chewing my food into small enough bits to swallow comfortably, fearing that I'm going to choke every time I swallow, because it's not just the mouth that gets tired, but the actual muscles needed to swallow, prevent choking, and make sure that food goes into the right part of the body so you don't get pneumonia or some other infection. And the mouth muscles getting tired isn't just something that affects eating either. My ability to speak gets affected because the muscles in my mouth can't form a bunch of the sounds in the English language. Buh. And my voice has been going out on me because the larynx, the so-called voice box, also has muscles that are affected by this condition, this situation I found myself facing in the last few months. When my voice goes out, I start to sound nasally, constricted, and eventually I can't really speak at all. I've learned to identify what's going on and stop at the nasally stage so I don't lose the ability to talk completely. At some point, my partner and I successfully got things together in our lives enough to watch The Nutty Professor with our daughter, which we've wanted to do for a very long time, and all of us realized collectively that Jerry Lewis sounded like this in the film when he was the professor and not the suave guy. So we began referring to the stage between my regular voice and the inability to speak as the Nutty Professor voice. My daughter and I have enjoyed many dinners together, just the two of us, while my partner is working, exercising, doing something with friends, or otherwise engaged. I value these times, though there may have been occasions in which I spent this time mindlessly. Recently, I was reviewing anti-drug abuse PSAs for a class I'm teaching, and there's this one from Philip Morris USA, the makers of Marlboro cigarettes. It shows different scenes of children talking and talking and talking while their parents listen attentively. The ad says that you should be fully present and patient with your kid no matter how long she goes on and on about something without breathing or pausing or even making clear how all the threads are connected. That one made me feel guilty and like she's going to start smoking cigarettes soon. Even though I know that Philip Morris agreed to stop airing the PSAs after legal threats, when research linked the commercials to an increase in cigarette smoking by youth who saw the ads. So my daughter and I are spending some quality time together, and now she's looking down at her food, and she's worried. A couple days before this meal, I was doing something. I just don't remember what it was now. Reading something, maybe, listening to music, reflecting in my head or in writing about what this whole health event might mean in terms of its sensibility versus absurdity, as well as its real effects in my life, something spurred me to consider, to wonder, to get curious about how afraid my child was for my life. Something invited me to allow myself to imagine this for a moment, and it was a crevasse, a separation in the ongoing narrative I had been constructing about how to deal with this new health situation. See, I knew that this muscle disorder wasn't going to end my life. I read all the peer-reviewed journal articles and book chapters written about this condition. I read all the blogs and advertisements and support group discussions and anarchist muscle disorder social media platforms about myasthenia gravis, a neuromuscular junction disorder that is one of the 91 muscular disorders included in the package of research programs that are under the auspices of the MDA, the Muscular Dystrophy Association, whose Labor Day telethon host for 45 years was Jerry Lewis. I knew I wasn't going to die. At least statistically speaking, that is. Yes, some people do die from what is called MG, but the vast majority don't. True, more people die from this than, say, Gilbert syndrome, something else I've been diagnosed with for many years, which apparently has no real effects at all, but still has its own name and diagnosis code, 277.5 in the current ICD-9. A lot more people die from myasthenia gravis than Gilbert syndrome, which I don't think is implicated in anyone's death, Still, probabilities that have been calculated with strong statistical significance were in my favor. Probabilities are a whole other dimension to this experience that I don't have time to address. And absurd healthcare interactions, from an MRI that had what was referred to as static on it, to the Mayo Clinic doctor, who had a sister who went to Humboldt State a long time ago and didn't seem particularly concerned when the transcription of his medical notes had Guillain-Barré syndrome, a very serious disorder, listed as one of my pre-existing conditions instead of Gilbert syndrome, which, as I've said, has no real effects. And the Mayo Clinic surgeon, the one who would later conduct surgery to remove my thymus gland, who said, "You have the mysterious condition of myasthenia gravis, and a tumor on the mysterious thymus gland." Now, I got really good care from people at the Mayo Clinic, for sure. But come on, referring to two major things related to what's going on with me as mysterious in the same sentence is a lot to deal with. Myasthenia gravis wasn't going to kill me. Sure, I conceived of this for a little while, but that was behind me. At this particular moment, though, when I flashed on my daughter's perception of the situation, I realized, I know this, but I wonder if she does. One of our dinners was coming up, and I thought it would be a good time to ask her, so I did. "Honey, are you afraid that I'm going to die?" She looks down at her food. She looks worried. And she says, "Yes." I'm not going to go into how I responded and all that. What I want to say is that this was a big deal. I was prepared for it. Still, this is my first time as a parent having a conversation like this with my child that was clearly more immediate and acute than the generic discussion about organisms and death and cycles of life. This was a chasm between the world of the everyday and the world of the numinous, the world of experiences that cannot be fully expressed in language, even by the great poets like Pablo Neruda, ineffable, like love, consciousness, balance and suffering, which isn't even really an analogy because words cannot describe the difference between things that cannot be fully described by words. This was a trauma to the narratives of my life, my daughter's life, my partner's life, and our collective lives together. My child feared that I was going to die, and I knew that this wasn't going to happen, but it could. She's not afraid of this anymore, at least that's what she says, and I believe her. Enough, at any rate, for now. This understanding of trauma as a rift in the storyline of my life can explain why, when I was lying down on the tray that inserts you into the CT machine a couple weeks ago to make sure that the tumor hasn't started to grow back, this can explain why I was flooded with intense thoughts and feelings and memories. Clinical people could call this an intrusion. I guess it depends on how you make sense of things. This can explain, though it's not the only possible explanation, why I had a harder time focusing on tasks when I started to get the nasty cold that was going around a few weeks ago. Because when I get sick, when any of us get sick, my immune system kicks into high gear, and part of the problem I have been facing is that my immune system isn't only targeting pathogens. I am willing to go to great lengths to avoid getting sick because the last time I had a bad virus, I got nutty professor voice a lot and couldn't swallow liquids without a lot of it coming out of my nose. This could be understood as avoidance, but I don't prefer to understand my experiences using clinical criteria from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, even if it is the newest, most accurate, most evidence-based fifth edition. How do we make sense of events, whether intense and brief or insidious and lengthy, that stand so far outside of the everyday? Lots of energy is spent trying to prove what causes trauma. Lots of energy is spent trying to explain what trauma is. Lots of energy, but I personally believe far less than is needed, is spent trying to address the effects of trauma. I get the whole metaphor of healing, and I think it fits, but I want to be clear that my understanding of healing is based less on the medical, biological, pathology-oriented way of thinking about illness, disease, and disorder, and more about people's capacities, their intentions, their hopes and dreams, and their ability for significant achievements given difficult situations. Problems like trauma effectively operate by limiting people's authority in their own lives. That is, being the primary author of their life. Two things worry me about talking about trauma. One is the invitation to compare traumas. Ranking severity of trauma doesn't make much sense to me, just like ranking oppression doesn't make sense to me. Still, I can't help but weigh what I have experienced as a person to the stories I have heard others tell and score myself on the not so very serious end of the scale. Also, I get concerned about trauma discourses that suggest one has to have been there in order to talk about the effects of trauma and skills for healing from trauma, or that people who have been there are rendered incapable of helping others until they've, quote, dealt with their issues, unquote. I do not believe that having experienced trauma or not having experienced trauma adds or subtracts to our ability to be helpful to others. If it did, then the invitation to atomize, turn into quantities, measure, compare, scale, and rank traumas would be hard to resist. Similar to the Australian social worker Michael White, who has since passed on, I understand trauma as an experience or set of experiences that disconnects a person from what is known and familiar. Trauma is a subjective experience where the severity of an individual event or the duration of multiple events are specific to a person. While the totality of effects of trauma are specific to a person, there are common shared effects as well. People often make statements such as, "I'm not acting or feeling like myself." They speak of the experience or experiences as something like a foreign object that does not fit with the experiences and values of their lives. They also speak of being swept away at times in the midst of these memories and how these effects challenge their day-to-day living. Healing from trauma, remembering that I don't mean this within a medical perspective, can occur through reestablishing what is preferred in one's life, reconnecting with what is of value in one's life. As John Stillman says in his Narrative Therapy Trauma Manual, stepping back into this position in relation to one's life allows individuals to make decisions about the directions of their life. And these values and beliefs are then used to determine the route ahead. This cannot be accomplished alone. That's too certain of a statement. It's a whole lot harder to accomplish this alone. Most people need others to be involved in supporting the steps a person takes. An audience must be involved in the listening, believing, and performance of the story of a person's life that existed before and has survived through trauma, however quiet, astounding, or difficult to enact. Here's what I think isn't particularly helpful. Internal metaphors such as peeling back onions or uncovering what has been repressed, as if there is some blemish that can be revealed and done away with. Coercive or intrusive practices that can re-traumatize people by reproducing the very same power relations that support many forms of violence against men, women, and children. Metaphors about human beingness that focus on release valves and suppression. As I've asked in other venues, why do we perceive ourselves as machines? Do you sometimes feel like you need to vent or let off steam or you'll overheat? You might need to decompress before you blow or have a breakdown. Perhaps you need a tune-up, or you know people who are high maintenance or low maintenance. I do not believe we are machines, and more specifically, I do not believe we are engines. Even if I actually do reference people like this from time to time, descriptions of healing from trauma that engage the language of warfare, such as fighting or combating trauma, or that describe people who experience trauma as target populations, and those that work with people to address trauma as frontline workers who are in the trenches. Strategies for addressing the negative effects of trauma that ask survivors to think about the positive. Remember what's good in your life, or be stronger for what did not kill you, even if I do ascribe to what has sometimes been called a strengths perspective. And as my colleague Carrie Slack reminded me when I was watching her teach social work students a couple weeks ago, while forgiveness is indeed possible and a powerful accomplishment for many people, it is certainly not necessary or required. Also, those technologies of anti-trauma work that suggest there are fixed and determined steps, stages, phases, or sequential workbook chapters, There's no pace for healing from trauma. I do believe that trauma can be understood in relation to neurological effects. This perspective is of tremendous help in liberating people, particularly young people and parents, from the sort of blame, shame, and guilt that comes along with failed attempts at navigating life's difficult circumstances. Understanding trauma in the context of neural pathways provides for helpful interventions for people who have directly experienced trauma, as well as those that support them, professionally and personally. I also believe there is risk in totalizing trauma as electrochemical. I get concerned that trauma can easily be localized inside a person's brain. When that happens, very real social and cultural contexts related to trauma can be rendered invisible, such as patriarchy, racism, homophobia, colonialism, sexism, and poverty, to name a few that lead to disproportionate incidences of trauma that involve people of color, women, people without enough money to get by, indigenous peoples, and people who identify as gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, or other gender identities. What I want to say can be understood in terms of the formation, deterioration, and reinforcement of neural pathways and the ways in which different sets of neurons fire simultaneously, but I'm going to say it differently. Trauma is an exceptional event or series of events. By that, I mean trauma is an event or series of events that stands outside of our dominant narrative or way of understanding the world, oneself, and one's relationship to the world. As social and language-centric beings, we are constantly making meaning of the information, communication, and exchanges we are part of. It's pretty easy to make sense of so-called everyday events. It doesn't take a whole lot of effort. The stories that help us make meaning of everyday events are everywhere to be found. They are embedded in social and cultural discourses. From the biology-based perspective, I'd say that the neural pathways for everyday experiences are well-formed and firing quite regularly. But everything we experience has to be storied. So the meaning that is constructed for exceptional events like trauma has to have a narrative structure too. If it didn't, there would be no way of fitting these events into the mind's narrative orientation. As a consequence of this construction of meaning, we have what we call reasons for the extraordinary, exotic, or strange that allow them to make sense. It is quite difficult to story these events in ways that are consistent with existing narratives of one's life because they stand so far outside them. The story that is constructed has to mitigate or at least make comprehensible a deviation from the dominant sociocultural stories which are deeply embedded in the narrative structure of our lives. When it's hard to story an experience or set of experiences because the narrative is in such stark contrast to other narratives of a person's life, we will pull from the canonical stories of culture that offer a way to make meaning, even if the real effect of this meaning-making is to limit other possible stories, possibilities for living. People may make sense of trauma through easily accessible and readily available explanations such as, I am not worthy, I brought this on, I deserve this, I'm crazy, and or I have PTSD. This makes sense if we appreciate that dominant Western culture is filled with narratives of individualism, personal responsibility, measurement, diagnosis, and scaling of normalness, and insurance codes. While these narratives may help to make sense of traumatic experiences, I believe they can occlude stories of people's preferences, their achievements, their values, what people stand for, and people's demonstrations of resistance and resilience, stories that strengthen and protect us in the face of difficult circumstances. Another concern about narratives that limit people's access to their skills of living is that they are usually quite thin. By thin, I mean that they rarely speak to a particular person's trajectory of life, their unique experiences. Typically, the canonical stories of culture that offer a way to make sense of very troubling experiences are generalized and universalized. They don't invite rich descriptions of people's lives. For example, the cultural canon might describe someone who is dealing with homelessness, who appears and sounds to be talking out loud to another person, as someone who only believes there is someone else around, and or is coping with a traumatic event. And there's a condition many people are plagued with called mental illness. And a particular disease or disorder of mental illness is post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. This can explain the behavior of a person who is conducting themselves outside of what is expected, but it doesn't really say much about who that person is, the narratives of this person's life. It's a way to understand, but it's a thin way to understand. None of what I am saying is in any way dismissing or minimizing the very real effects of these narratives. People diagnosed with PTSD frequently experience significant and troubling effects of trauma, which can be understood in physical, emotional, psychiatric, and spiritual contexts. Moreover, many people who meet the diagnostic criteria for PTSD deal with legal and economic challenges as well. What I am suggesting is that there are also narratives of people's lives, ways to make meaning, that emerge from people's lived experience before, during, and after, if there is an after, trauma. The canonical narratives help people make meaning, but usually, perhaps not always, these meanings render other narratives invisible. Narratives that could be helpful in overcoming the troubling effects of trauma. Simply put, the diagnosis of 309.81 does not tell me very much about a person's lived experience and does very little to assist people in addressing the difficulties they face. In wrapping this up, I want to say that what I have presented is necessarily an incomplete story. Just as I left out parts of the story I started with, like the cast member at Disneyland, that's what the employees are called, who clearly had no idea that I was dealing with the effects of a serious muscle disorder when she shouted out to me and my family, "Come on, Dad, give us a real smile," and held everyone else back from entering the line we were in while she required us to take another picture. My talk of healing from trauma is missing important parts. It's missing parts that I know are missing, and it's missing parts that I'm not even realizing. I have not spoken to methods for individual, family, organizational, and community work in relation to trauma. This is a very important topic. There are great published resources on this topic, such as the free Practical Guide to Stop Interpersonal Violence, offered by Creative Interventions out of Oakland. There are also innumerable unpublished personal accounts of addressing the effects of trauma. I have not spoken to accountability practices when it comes to interpersonal trauma and family violence. For example, a man's violence toward women, children, and other men cannot be excused by environmental circumstances and social inequalities. This doesn't mean they are unimportant. It just means that interpersonal violence requires interpersonal accountability. I also haven't richly described the relationship between trauma and marginalization, and this, I think, is a significant gap in my address. Trauma can affect anyone. This is clear. It is also clear that trauma does not affect everyone equally. There are many reasons for this, often couched in terms like risk factors and protective factors. Certainly, individual biochemical, neurological, and psychological characteristics can mitigate the negative effects of trauma, and there are some therapeutic processes that can weaken the effects of trauma. Yet it is quite clear to me that trauma, while not distinguishing between people's age, the color of their skin, the language they speak, who they choose to love, or how much money they have, trauma is strengthened and empowered by structural and interpersonal discrimination. Power relations based on race, class, gender, sexuality, disability, gender identity, and many other social locations support opportunities for subjecting people to trauma and hinder people's abilities to get out from under the negative effects of trauma. I had a professor in my philosophy program when I was getting my BA, Richard Schmidt, who wrote something. I don't remember where I first saw it or why I thought to write it down, because that's not something I had ever done before I went to college, write down the words of another person that resonated with me strongly. Here's his thought. It is an interesting reflection on capitalist ways of thinking that we regard threatening someone with a gun or a baseball bat as an illegal act, whereas threatening someone with poverty or unemployment is regarded as a legitimate move in the marketplace. Yet poverty, malnutrition, poor medical care, and lack of education pose as much threat of physical harm as does the threat with gun or club. Thank you.
And thank you, Dr. Ronnie Schwartz. Very thoughtful keynote address as we deal with healing from trauma. And that is what this week is all about. And as we conclude our 18th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign, we're coming to you live from the Women's Club on J Street in Eureka. And we acknowledge this at the very beginning of the broadcast, but I want to talk about it again real quick before we take a quick break. This Healing Breakfast is on November 22nd, which is National Stop the Violence Day. That day was chosen deliberately as a day that of horrific violence that changed history forever, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Today is the 50th anniversary of that act, which is amazing to me. I was 6 years old at the time. I remember it like it was yesterday. We chose this day rather than to remember it as a day of horrific violence, as a day of peace, a day where we can turn a corner, a day where we can take personal responsibility to make the world a better place. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to have some live music again. Our all-star quartet assembled just for this, the Heartbeat Quartet, right here on KHUM. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. All right, and you got it on KHUM, Cutton, Eureka, Arcata, and Blue Lake, and streaming on the web at KHUM.com. We are coming to you live from Eureka Women's Club on J Street in Eureka. It's our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign's Healing Breakfast, and we are going to get back to some live music in just a second. But first, I want to remind you that if you have a CalFresh card and you go to our local farmer's market, you can receive bonus dollars with the Market Match Program. Fresh, affordable vegetables and fruits at a reasonable price. This is a great way to stretch your budget if you're on the CalFresh card. Okay, you want to find out more, you can visit humfarm.org, and they'll give you all that information. So again, I want to introduce the Heartbeat Quartet. It's an all-star vocal quartet put together just for this event. It's Luke Sikora, it is Steve Nobles, Elizabeth Harrington, and Joe Kaselka. And I'll let you guys take it away.
Sweet and weary head. Night is falling. You've come to journey's end. Sleep now in the dream of the ones who came before. Calling from across a distant shore. Why do you weep? What are these tears upon your face? Soon you will see all of your fears will pass away, safe in my arms. You're only sleeping. What can you see? On the horizon, why do
into the
Them again. Again, that is the Heartbeat Quartet assembled just for this event. Thank you, guys. Truly fantastic. So while we were listening to our keynote address, which really dealt with a lot of stuff in depth, and I really appreciate Dr. Schwartz's thoughts on that. He spent obviously a lot of time dealing with that and bringing that information to us. Carolyn and I were kind of like talking back and forth, saying, you know, there's a lot of stuff that that he's brought up that would actually make some interesting stuff to talk about, right?
Yeah, I think so. The whole concept of story, that we are living our stories and we're writing our stories, and we're deciding who and what it is that we are in relationship to the things that have happened to us, many of which we have absolutely no control over. So certainly sexual abuse, violence, rape in the military, the very things that we've been covering, as well as things like Dr. Schwartz's illness, the two life-threatening cancers that I've experienced in the last 10 years. And it's just, you know, so what story are you going to tell about this? And there are things you have no control over, but there's lots you do have control over. And I just want to pick up on that for a second and apply it to the cancer situation, because in March I was told by one of my doctors that I had 6 months to live and that I should prepare my family and myself and accept the inevitable. And I just went off the edge of the cliff, you know. I went into a depression that lasted for a week until I got really, really pissed. And I said he had no right to say that to me, because nobody knows when you're going to live and when you're going to die. Nobody knows. And one of the things that I learned as I worked through a lot of the sexual abuse in my childhood was that there's a point where you have to stop identifying. I had to stop identifying, I should say, with being a victim, and just say, "Damn it, this is my life. You know, I'm gonna, do with it what I choose. I didn't have a choice about what happened to me. I didn't have a choice about having cancer, but I do have a choice about how I live the days that I have. So I decided that I wasn't going to die and that I was going to live as fully as I possibly could. And fortunately, I had other doctors who did support me in that, and they were really very positive about the possibility of wellness. And he had said to me that I should use those days doing what I wanted to do, so I decided to go backpacking with my husband in the mountains in the Sierras. We went on two backpacking trips. And then I came back. My husband asked me what I wanted to do with my fall, and I decided to walk the Camino in Spain, a 500-mile journey walking from France to Santiago. Fabulous, fabulous experience.
It's pretty good for a dying woman, huh?
Yeah, so I was supposed to die a couple of months ago, and here I am. just got back from this incredible experience, and I didn't understand why I went until after I went, but I was engaged in life spiritually, emotionally, physically, psychologically. I was speaking in another language because I'm a little bit of a Spanish speaker, so I tried to speak Spanish all the time when I was there. Socially, I met so many people. Every day I slept in a different bed, you know. Every day I saw a different town. Every day I was just so deeply engaged in life. And so, you know, I took a narrative which was this, you know, he had a script for me, which was, okay, Carolyn, we're going to call hospice and you're going to get your will written, you know. And I did write my will, but I did it a couple of years ago. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm in remission, as you all know. Remission is, hey, it could last a few months, it can last a few years, it could last for the rest of your life. And so that part I can't write, but I can write this part, which is to live fully every day. So I don't know, I just had to riff off of
Ronnie
said.
It's a great point. It really is a great point. I mean, the reality is that life is fatal. I mean, you're born, we're all going to leave at some point.
That's right.
It's the way it is. And, you know, being pronounced, you know, dead, basically, that's what you were. Many people at that point, it's just throw the off switch. Guess
sure.
It's done.
You live down to your doctor's prognosis, I think. A lot of times people do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's giving them an incredible control over your story. It's allowing them to write the ending of your story.
Yeah, I think it's a disservice. The reality is that, you know, most doctors will just, you know, give you, you know, they're just quoting basically odds. And, you know, it is just odds. And, you know, the reality is we all have a limited amount of time. We don't know how much time that is. I had a few years ago, it's coming up on 6 years now, on my ride home on my bike, I came very close to leaving this mortal coil without a plan. I was just like, wow, you know, I was hit by a motor vehicle on my bike on 101, and I survived it. And after that, it was like, wow, we shouldn't take every day for granted. You just don't know what's going to happen. I mean, you know, in your situation, you were kind of given a glimpse of what could be, and you chose, I think I'm going to live, which is a wonderful thing to do, by the way. I've had many friends. I had a very good friend of mine who was 17 years ago, was given a few months to live, and she lived a very, very long and happy life. You know, she has since passed, but she was in remission for 17 years and did an amazing amount of things. It basically took off, you know, she was like, that's when her career took off. She decided, well, if I'm already dead, why don't I just do all this stuff?
Exactly. You know, and I think that one of the points that Dr. Schwartz made was, the word that it made me think of was agency. He
mm-hmm.
he talked about healing from trauma, being able to tell your own story, and I think it isn't just. I mean, you know, I didn't I didn't survive because I made a decision to live, but I think it was part of it. And I think when we're dealing with trauma, agency's been taken away from us, especially if we've been abused as children, but also as adults. I mean, my experience is childhood abuse. And agency's been taken away. And in constructing your story, as he said, you get the power back. You get the power back to decide, what does this mean? And what is the meaning in my life? And what meaning am I going to make of this?
Absolutely. And, you know, the whole thing about healing from trauma, you know, many times when we experience trauma, at that point we feel our life is over. You know, we might as well just throw in the towel. But there is life after trauma. You know, being diagnosed with cancer and being told that you have a few months to live, that is absolutely a trauma.
You betcha.
That is a trauma. And, you know, there's several paths you could have taken. You really don't know what's going to happen, but you do your best and you stay positive. And my talk with Dr. Michael Yellowbird yesterday, you know, talking so much about mindfulness, really has a lot to do with, you know, where our heads are at. You know, are oftentimes our bodies follow.
Yes. Yes, and I have to say that one of the things about walking the Camino is that it is an absolute lesson in mindfulness, because you are in the day, that day, experiencing that walk at that moment, that town, that cow, that mushroom. I mean, you know, it's you couldn't be more deeply involved in mindfulness.
Yeah, and I don't want to say that that trauma or this kind of diagnosis is a gift. It's not. But you can take from it something very positive. You can take this horrific thing and bounce from it, go in a different direction, you know, as you did, as so many people have, as many people in this room have done. You know, they've taken what was something terrible and moved it to a different direction.
But it definitely does take as long as it takes.
Absolutely.
And really, as Ronnie pointed out, we're all going to go at it our own mm-hmm. rate. But I wanted to get Gina and Janice into this conversation, and
please.
I especially love the telling our own story, and especially the words that we use to tell that story. Until we have the power to just tell it for ourselves, sometimes it's told for us. Mm-hmm. So, Gina and Janice, any comments that you want to make? I just want to make sure we get you in here.
Thank you, Sherry. I'm actually very inspired by all the little synapses that are flashing down off of Ron's story and intersection with Carol's story. And what's coming up for me as an emerging Indigenous scholar and thanatologist, I'm quite interested in understanding. Well, first I'll share this statistic with everyone. Those that are data-driven, I share this often when I'm giving a talk, and that is 100% of us in this room are going to die. And we often forget that. And in thanatology, we look at endeavoring to understand the various ways that we are living until our last breath, as Carol so inspiringly, you know, shared with us. So I'm become interested in understanding trauma and who's defining trauma and who's defining trauma for me. And so I jump off from, I started looking at etymology of trauma, like what is that word? Where did it come from? And the word is descended from its Greek origins with the signifier ditrino, and it means to penetrate. And this is a German signifier for dream, which is Traum. And Freud describes the trauma as an event occurring in one's experience that's circumscribed by the intensity of the event. And we heard Michael Yellowbird is also a friend of mine and colleague, but we heard Ron describe the futility of ranking our trauma and comparing our trauma. And I have often come in contact with folks ranking our suffering. You know, suffering is suffering, and mindfulness helps us come in contact with understanding that. It's also a perspective I move from. And so getting back to this description of trauma, the narrative is an important instrument when attempting to navigate this landscape. None of us knows what that looks like for each other. And so whether it's expressed by an individual or collective, and there's transformative potentials in that, like we talked about, in one of those is healing. And the narrative is a critical landmark for us, especially when we mediate that through art and poetry, such as Carol's powerful book, Strong at Heart, and even this quilt over the corner. I mean, that's a performative action in social justice, deciding to sit down at this quilt and engage in our own symbolic, you know, creating our symbol for others to witness our story. So I wanted to start looking, what are the analytical frameworks? Who's deciding what that is for me? And it starts to decide who defines it, what's the claim of the effect, and how's it represented and manifested, and what's at stake in defining that. These are huge social justice issues, as Ron pointed out. So then I began to look at from the indigenous perspective of what it was like to be have a holistic mindset and working in the biomedical model. And I'm moving from holism, how that began to slowly be eroded away in my experience, and began this work that I'm on now as a journey in soul reclamation. And I was came in contact with the story of Jean Boleyn that talks about dismemberment. So I don't know if people are familiar with indigenous views of dismemberment. And if you think of that word itself, this coming apart. Jean Boleyn tells a story, we're talking about the Greeks, called Procrustes' Bed. And every child, when you're born, she says, is on its way to Athens. Now, what you're not told is when you get to the gate of Athens, there's a gatekeeper, and his name is Procrustes. And before you can enter the gate of this, you know, wisdom, you are asked to lie down on his bed. And so if you are too long, your feet are cut off. If your arms are hanging off the edge, well, then let's cut off that arm so you fit. Now, that's one definition of dismemberment. And just looking around the room at the faces when I tell this story, this narrative, I can feel in my body the somatic response to that. Trauma also lives in my body, the story of this trauma. You start to contract a little. Now, when you think about dismemberment from an indigenous perspective, this is the coming apart. It's an unconceptualized reality. You're moving to this edge of an unconceptualized reality that I don't know yet in order to access healing potentials that Carol talked about. Had she not come apart and decided to go to this journey to the Camino. And Michael's talk about, Ron, talking about his coming apart. What are these healing potentials that are available to us? So it's a little different. Who's defining this? Why are we defining this? And then you have codes like the DSM-5 and 6 that are...
Excellent. I'll tell you what, we've got a lot of wonderful resource tables all around the room. And generally what I do is I hand our wireless mic to Amy, and she runs all around the room with that wireless mic. But the mic does not seem to be working. So if I could, I'm going to take a break. And Amy, if you could just corral various people to come over, and we can talk on the same mic that the keynote speaker that Ronnie used earlier, if that works for you. Okay, she will be right back. And so will we. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to the Women's Club here at... here on J Street in Eureka. It is open and free to the public, so please stop on by. We still have a lot of wonderful resource tables, which you're going to be hearing from in a moment. Lots of delicious pastries from Velatini Baking Company. Also, Amy baked a few as well. Let's see what else. We've got delicious coffee from our good friends at Signature Coffee, beautiful flowers from Sun Valley Floral Farm. So, again, our sponsors have a few words, and we'll hear from some of our resource tables and, of course, more music from the Heartbeat Quartet coming up shortly as well. All righty, it's 23 minutes after 9 o'clock. It's our 18th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign as we wrap it up with our Healing Breakfast live from the Women's Club on J Street in Eureka. A wonderful room full of people and, of course, a room full of resource tables. And since our roving microphone does not appear to be working today... We're making our folks rove over to us, and Quail is here from the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence.
Good morning, Cliff.
Good morning.
So my name is Sister Gaiety, and I am the treasurer of Eureka Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence. We are a 21st century order of queer nuns who are dedicated to expiating stigmatic guilt and promulgating universal joy through a ministry of habitual manifestation. So we Eureka Sisters do all sorts of good things for our community. We raise over $20,000 each year for local nonprofit organizations that we collaborate with, primarily through our fundraising bingos, as well as provide specific spiritual ministry to the LGBTQ community. So the Eureka Sisters would just like to remind you, if you need us, we are here for you to assist you in your healing journey.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And again, these resource tables are all around the room. They're here for you. So please take advantage. And please step up to the microphone. Introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Linda Shapiro. I'm president of PFLAG. That stands for Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians, Gays, Transgenders, Intersect, Allies. We just have the whole alphabet. We welcome everyone to our meetings. We meet on the second Monday of the month at 6:30 in the social hall of the First Congregational United Church of Christ. That's on J Street. We welcome everyone to come. It's a confidential support group. And other than just having our meetings, we also like to go out into the schools. Last year I showed Bully, and I'm looking forward to showing it to other schools. And we encourage starting Gay Straight Alliance clubs in schools. I know a lot of the high schools around have it, but we're starting to try to get them in a lot of the middle schools. So we invite everyone to come and help support us. We also plan on starting a speakers bureau that will go to the schools. So help us as we try to educate other people about the LGBTQIA community. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mary Ann Hayes Mariani with the North Coast Rape Crisis Team. And we have two offices, one here in Humboldt and another one in the Del Norte County, Crescent City. And we provide ongoing support services for all survivors, any age, any gender, who've experienced sexual violence. And we're available 24 hours a day. Every minute of every day, there is a counselor available to listen, support you, believe you, and not judge you about this issue. I really want to appreciate Kayhum and Cliff and Sherry for taking this opportunity for all of us to come together and break the silence about the violence in our community and to promote healing, because healing can happen, and that's really important for us to pay attention to and embrace that. So part of our services are responding to survivors. If people make a choice about reporting, we can accompany them through that whole legal process and inform them about all their options. And people who choose not to report, we're there to support them as well, because there's no right or wrong way to address this issue. Like, I really appreciate the panelists talking about that. People need to define their own healing and find their own voice and what's right for them. And we really want to support everyone in doing that and promoting their loved ones and allies to support them in making their own decisions about that. We also provide education to the community. We start from the very little ones of preschool. Say no, get to a safe place and tell someone, and support them in finding their voice. We have very interactive curriculum for all ages to break the silence about this issue and assist people in communicating about it, talking to each other about it. We know, especially for the youth in the schools, that we need to have more dialogue and for them to be able to define what's going on for them, what is healthy, loving connections versus violent relationships. So we want to promote that kind of dialogue within our community and acknowledge the reality that we live with. So our crisis line number, 24 hours a day, is 445-2881 in Humboldt. And in Del Norte, it's 465-2851. Thank you for participating in this event.
Thanks for coming and being such a big part of it this year.
Hi, I'm Mary Beth Bynum, and I work at the District Attorney Victim Witness. And we help people through the court system to reduce the trauma they experience. We educate them about the court system. We hook them up to services. We also accompany them to police, to meetings. And we hook them up to counseling through our victim compensation program and help them relocate. We're at 712 4th Street in Eureka, and our phone number is 445-7417.
Thank you so much.
My name is Suzanne Avola, and I'm a social worker with Two Feathers, Native American Family Services. And we are a chartered entity of Big Lagoon Rancheria located in McKinleyville. And our phone number is 839-1933. And we offer services for all Natives and those living in Native homes. We have social work, case management services, and therapeutic counseling and culture groups. We have a Native Women's Beating Group going on right now, which is open. And we have the children's groups that will be starting after the holidays, which will include drumming and beating. So we are located in McKinleyville. We're open Monday through Friday, and our number is 839-1933. Give us a call. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And if you've been seeing those beautiful quilts behind you, here's Oceana Madrone.
Hi, I'm Oceana Madrone with the Healing Quilt Project. And the Healing Quilt Project addresses violence against women and children. It gives those who have been silenced a chance to tell their stories. It helps to break the silence and isolation that survivors may feel, and it provides a place for the community to offer hope and comfort and support. I'd like to encourage everyone who is here today to come over to our table and make a quilt square. The squares will be sewn up into a quilt and be brought back to next year's event for everyone to see the quilt that was made. Thank you.
Thank you. And really, thanks to all the folks who are here providing services to our community. You do tireless work, often thankless, but we want to thank you for your thankless work because it is really just absolutely wonderful. I don't think this community could survive without all of you. And let's see here. Oh, Joey, did we have something? Oh, you want to? Okay.
Why don't we do that right now?
Okay, we certainly could do that.
Oceana, would you like to come back up to the microphone and talk a little bit about this quilt? And meanwhile,
every year a quilt is made and given to some wonderful person. You can use that same microphone you did before.
One of my favorite parts of the Healing Quilt Project, it's when we get to give the quilts away. And the quilt that was made with the squares last year, I'm very happy to present to Paula Arrowsmith-Jones.
Yay.
She's not here today because she is recuperating from the terrible car crash. This quilt is to show my appreciation for all of the work that she has done over the years and to be able to try to offer some comfort and support to her while she's in this healing process.
Fantastic. Good choice.
So, Marianne, would you first also to thank Marianne for stepping in this year and being on two radio panels
yes.
and being
So wonderful. Such a wonderful guest. And so, Marianne, would you like to just say a little something?
On Paula's behalf there.
Well, I can't thank you enough on behalf of Paula because as a sister in this work and her dedication and commitment to the issue, I really want to appreciate your warmth and your healing energy because it has been, as we know, as the panel's talked about, she's feeling it. She's feeling wrapped in it, and it is promoting her healing. And I want to thank you as a loving friend of hers for all that energy and for that she can be in her home and be all cozy and have this wrapped around her as she's healing is really very thoughtful and very generous of heart. Thank you.
And I just wanted to add one more thing. While I'm presenting this quilt to Paula, I know that Rape Crisis always works as a team, and I so much appreciate also Marianne and Ruthann and all of the other people who work at Rape Crisis Team. When I really needed help and support, they were there for me and helped me through and helped my family through. I cannot say enough good things about them. And if you are feeling in need of help, they're the most wonderful people that you could turn to.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Well, we've got several things to take care of. We've got the check. We always have a check that we present to an organization, part of our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing Fund, which is managed by the Humboldt Area Foundation. And even through the financial crisis, the thing is still surviving and still doing just fine. So we are very happy about that. So we are going to be doing that. We also need to hear a little bit more from our panel and another set of tunes, of course, from the Heartbeat Quartet. But first, we've got to let our sponsors say just a few words. Okay, you've got it on KHUM. It's our 18th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign. And we are coming to you live from the Eureka Women's Club on J Street in Eureka, a room full of wonderful and supportive people. We've had some terrific talk thus far, and we've got really a few minutes left. We're going to be hearing a little bit more from our panel. We're also going to invite anyone here who wants to share something that if they would like to, they certainly can. But I think right now, I think we want to get back to our panel, because we haven't heard from all of our panel yet, have we?
So, Janice, let's put you on the spot.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, one of the things that really struck me in listening to the rest of the panel members and the people coming up is really how important words are, both when we're describing trauma and we're talking about the people who have been survivors who have come in. One of the things that you see in the medical model is that people are talked about as patients, meaning that the problem kind of resides with them and they're coming in to get fixed. One of the things that the counseling community has always tried to do is kind of, you know, tone that down a bit and say that people are clients coming in. But that still has a little bit of this whole kind of stigma attached to it. In our department at UIHS, in the Behavioral Health Department, what we've really been trying to move towards recently is a better trauma-informed care model. And as part of that, we're changing the words that we're using. So instead of talking about people coming in to see us as clients, we're talking about them coming in that they're community members, that they're people that just need a little help that are coming in to see us. We're trying to really work on that. Now, one of the things that I personally have always found to be very important is that it doesn't matter who's coming in to see me. That is one of the toughest things that it is for anybody to have to do, to go in to see a counselor and put out their story to a person that they don't even know. That they have to feel like, oh, there's something that has happened to me or something that's going on with me that I need to go see this other person that I don't know from anybody and just bear my life story out to them. So one of the most important things that I've always felt and have told to interns and anybody else that I talk to is that it's important to honor the people, the community members that come in to see us, because that's the only way to really start to establish trust, to make them feel like they're worthwhile people, that there's not something wrong with them, that whatever is going on has been their way of trying to cope with the tremendous things that have happened to them. And working in the Native American community, when we look at historical trauma, when we look at all the different things that have happened to the Native community, and over generations this has happened, that there are just so many things. We have to realize that people's behaviors, that if they've been suffering with substance abuse, if they've been suffering with depression, anxiety, anger outbursts, that these were things that they learned how to do to try to cope with the terrible things that have happened. And if we take people from where they are, from where they're coming in to see us, that gives us a basis to be able to start to establish trust, to be able to get them to feel that they're safe with us, that they have a place that they can come in and talk and heal and do their work. And so I think that that was one of the most important things that I really wanted to get out today, is that it's just really important to honor everyone, that we shouldn't be putting blame on people, making them feel shamed or any of those things. We need to honor them and let them know that we honor them. There's many times when somebody has finished telling me their story that I just straight out tell them that I am so privileged to be able to be a recipient of the courage that they showed to be able to share that story with me. And so that was one of the things that I really wanted to make sure that we kind of, when we're talking about healing, kind of got through, because to be anybody to be able to heal, you have to be able to set that stage so that they can actually be able to do their own work and to be able to do the healing.
And that is so beautifully said. And I would really encourage anyone who is listening that first step is being able to tell the story. It has to get out of your body. That's where it's been lodged, and that's where it stays, and that's where it causes further suffering. It can be said, and you're strong enough to say it, to a person who can really listen, and they're strong enough to hear it. So that's really the first step, and that's why we're so privileged to be in this room, all of us, and to know that in this room there are so many of us who have survived really hard starts, and then it only got harder, and then for a lot of us it got better. So we're here to tell you it can and it will get better, but the hard part has to come first.
And speaking of which, every year we always like to invite anyone who is here who would like to share. You can use your name or not. Generally, we have, again, Amy run around the room with a microphone, but unfortunately our wireless is not functioning today. But if anyone is here that wanted to briefly share something, and again, have this be a step in the healing process, and you certainly are not required to do so, but anyone who would like to certainly can. The microphone up front here will work just fine. And anyone who maybe wanted something to say but really doesn't want to stand in front of a group and talk can certainly say something to my wife, Amy, here, and she will jot it down and pass that on. So anyone who would like to come forward to talk right now, that is absolutely fine. We're ready for you to share if you would like to. Or not. It's tough. I do realize that.
It's a cold morning.
Well, you know, yeah. Just speaking from the indigenous perspective, it takes not just courage, but some stories, mm-hmm. you must be prepared to receive mm-hmm. these stories. Some stories are meant to be told at a certain time of
sure.
the day or a certain time of the year. Preparation for story tending is important.
We have to let people do it in their own time and in their own way.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And there is a little napkin in front of me, and the author is anonymous, mm-hmm. and it says, "I was shot."
I got that too.
Yeah, mm. yeah. So in the room, we know that there are people who have had physical trauma to their body, spiritual trauma, emotional trauma. Certainly, many of us having survived adverse childhood experiences, and it unites us. Those experiences really do connect us, because when we say, and Ronnie was really, he was really eloquent in saying, you don't have to have had all these experiences to feel connected. That knowing that we all share this human experience which is fragile and filled with amazing strength, that we can be that for each other, and we can hear what's unspeakable.
And one thing I'd like to encourage also is talking to people who are fortunate enough to have gone through their entire lives without experiencing any trauma. There are a couple. There's a handful of them out there, I'm certain. And if you're saying, I cannot relate to any of this, well, I'll tell you what, you are a fellow human being, and you can be there for someone who has experienced this. I mean, that's what it's all about, is, you know, being there for someone. You don't necessarily have to have experienced this yourself to be a caring and giving person. Mm. You may understand it on a more visceral level, but you certainly don't have to have experienced it. And Amy, you had something you wanted to say, yes?
I just wanted to say that over the years, people have taken the opportunity to share things privately with us. And for those of you who have done so, whether this year or in the past, I just want to say thank you for trusting us with what you had to say, and know that you have our profound healing and loving thoughts as just one human to another. And I feel honored to have been the one you talked to.
Absolutely. And we have got a check that we have to present to... we have to do it. We have it. We have it all written out.
First to present.
Yes. It's our privilege to do so. And for the first time ever, I think, we actually have the real check rather than the big fake one that Amy usually makes. And we get it turned into a real one down the road. And I think what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break. We'll get that check ready to get presented. And we will wrap up this wonderful event with some wonderful music from the Heartbeat Quartet. But first, these words. We are about 9 minutes away from 10 o'clock. This healing breakfast, as always, has really gone by fast. And what I have in my hand is a check written from the Humboldt Area Foundation to a wonderful organization that unfortunately could not be here today. We are giving this check in the amount of $850 to WISH. This is the Women's Crisis Shelter in Southern Humboldt. So accepting on their behalf, we've got Sherry here. Let me hand it to you. You can actually
Yay.
Do the accepting.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And on behalf of WISH, I am certain that if Mary and the other volunteers who are keeping that organization going 24/7 were here, they would say thank you, KHUM, thank you, Stop the Violence Fund, and just acknowledging that so much work goes on in the outer regions of our county, out of the Humboldt Bay Area, and that oftentimes Southern Humboldt people feel isolated and not acknowledged, that this is an important recognition to make for all of the work that the volunteers do to keep women and children and people safe in Southern Humboldt. So on behalf of WISH, thank you very much.
Yes, indeed. And these guys have been operating on a shoestring for some time. Don't get any federal support, and happy to help them out. And we have got a lot of people to thank. And I always wind up forgetting someone, but there's a lot of people that we need to thank. We need, first of all, thank the Women's Club of Eureka for letting
yes.
us use this wonderful facility. Thank you, guys.
Right.
And
we want to thank our panelists this morning. A wonderful, thoughtful discussion, and Dr. Ronnie Swartz for an inspirational keynote, and for all of the people who are staffing the tables today, who got here early this cold morning, and all of our guests who have attended the Healing Breakfast. And the most important person for me on my list is Amy Berkowitz.
Yes. She is the she's the backbone of this whole thing.
She is the silent partner who, at least we get to see today, who does so much to make Stop the Violence, Start the Healing this incredibly community treasure that it is.
And she has been there from the very, very, very beginning. So thank you, Amy. Also, we want to thank our good friends at Velatini Baking Company for providing us some delicious yummies. And, of course, Signature Coffee for providing us some delicious, wonderful coffee. The Cajun Blend, always fantastic. The beautiful flowers we're seeing all over the room are provided by Sun Valley Floral Farm. Yes, indeed. They always come to the plate and always are here to make things beautiful.
And the quilts that are just lovely to behold. And all of the panel people for this past 3 weeks, including all the guests who drove down to Ferndale and were able to do interviews either by phone or by in person. So many people to thank.
Absolutely. And I want to thank the listeners of this campaign. I know there are way more fun things to be listening to. I know on Fridays there's Friday Funnies. We've given up that for the past 3 weeks. There's lots of great music that we've given up on for the past 3 weeks as well. But I think it's all for a good cause. I think every once in a while, sometimes we have to deprive ourselves of something to make something good happen in the community. So thank you, our listeners, for putting up with this. I also want to thank our Heartbeat Quartet. They've put together this all-star quartet just for this event. I hope they stay together because they're really fantastic. Elizabeth Harrington, Joe Kaselka, Luke Sikora, and, of course, Steve Nobles. And I think we're going to wrap this up with
One more thank you.
Oh, please, please.
Thank you, sister. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, yes. And the Heartbeat Quartet.
Somebody hold me too close. Somebody love me too deep. Somebody sit in my chair and ruin my sleep. And make me aware of being alive, being alive. Somebody need me too much.
Somebody need me too much.
Somebody know me too much.
Somebody know me too much.
Somebody pull me up shore. For being alive,
make me alive,
make me alive, make me confused, mock me with praise, let me be you. Days, but alone.
Make me confused.
Is alone.
Mock me with praise.
Let me be you.
Vary my days.
Survive.
Fantastic. Stephen Sondheim. And I think you got another one to help close us out, correct?
One more.
Sorry.
It's live radio. Heartbeat Quartet, wrapping us up here live from our 18th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing breakfast here at the Women's Club in on J Street in Eureka. Thank you all for listening to this campaign for the past 3 weeks, and we will hand it back to Mike in the Cahum studio.